Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is General Insurance Company against the Clark Mall Corporation. Mr. McVisk.
Thank you, Your Honor. And Your Honors, may it please the Court. My name is William McVisk, and I'm representing General Insurance Company of America in this case. This case is here on a Rule 54B finding after the Court entered judgment on the pleadings on the question of whether General Insurance Company had a duty to defend this case. Standard of review is de novo. Your Honors, this case...
You've actually stated my initial question, which is whether this case is properly here. Whether it's properly here depends on whether this is a proper Rule 54B judgment. Whether it's a proper Rule 54B judgment depends on the relation between this duty to defend claim and the counterclaims that remain in the district court. And the parties' briefs provide no help whatever at analyzing that question. Your brief says there are a bunch of claims and asserts they're unrelated, but doesn't tell us what they are. And I hate to say this, Mr. McVisk, we don't just take counsel's conclusions. We need to know what they are. So what are they?
The claims against General Insurance Company at this time, the counterclaims, all relate to question of whether General Insurance Company has a duty to indemnify Discount Mega Mall with respect to the fire that occurred on the property damage portion of its policy. There is a claim remaining on whether we have a duty to indemnify under the third party part of the claim, but that is not a counterclaim. That is actually part of our initial claim. The counterclaims all have to do with Discount Mega Mall and the various discount defendants seeking. I'm sorry, Judge.
No, I'm sorry.
They are all seeking indemnity under the property damage part of the policy. There were two. There was both a general liability and a property damage.
And that any indemnity claims are premature. There's no problem with using Rule 54B to bring up duty to defend issues separately from duty to indemnify issues. But that's the critical question. Do any of the counterclaims concern the duty to defend in any way?
Not in any way. No. They're all under the other part of the policy. None of them involve the duty to defend. The duty to defend was finally determined by the trial court.
What's the status of the state court litigation?
The state court litigation is ongoing. It is. There were some attempts to settle the state court litigation. They weren't successful. I'm not fully familiar with it because we're not defending the case. But as I understand it, discovery, et cetera, is ongoing.
Speaking of discovery, what discovery do you anticipate needing with respect to the applicability of the exclusion?
There probably is going to be very little discovery, but I would anticipate, Your Honor, the main thing I will need to do is take the depositions of the parks, the people who owned the property, and the security guards, because we believe the evidence will establish that at the time of this loss, the parks exercised exclusive control over the entire Mega Mall building. At the time of the loss, they excluded tenants from the building. They had keys to every entrance to the building. The tenants did not have keys to any of the entrances to the building. The security people for the Discount Mega Mall went in, inspected all of the leases, all of the lease spaces, to make sure nobody was there, to make sure it was all safe, and et cetera. And these were all alleged in our proposed amended complaint. We believe we can establish that. I think all we would need to do would be to either possibly we could do requests to admit with respect to those facts, because I think those would be admitted. If we didn't succeed at request to admit, I would expect a deposition, and that would be about it. Then we could proceed forward.
Another thing that I was kind of wondering about is this. Based on the pre-filing investigation that you conducted, could you at least have alerted Judge Cole to what you expected the evidence to show is the applicability of the care, custody, and control, exclusion?
I thought I was doing that when I filed a proposed amended complaint, Your Honor, because I wouldn't have filed a proposed amended complaint if I didn't think I had evidence to prove those facts. The problem was that I understood this to be a Rule 12C motion, where I was limited to the pleadings as pled in the facts of the complaint, and I was assuming that under Rule 12C, the facts I alleged in my proposed amended complaint would be considered to be true. And I don't see any reason why I should not have, or why the federal rules don't essentially require Judge Cole to have considered the allegations both in the complaint.
It's not one of what the federal rules require. The question is one of substantive relevance under Illinois law. If Illinois law says that the relevant facts are those stated in the underlying complaint, then you could plead anything you want, but they'll all be irrelevant.
True.
Right?
If that were the standard.
The question is not one of pleading, but of relevance. So if you want to address the question whether they're relevant under Illinois law, that would probably be more helpful.
All right. Well, Your Honor, I think there's no question that that's relevant under Illinois law, because the Illinois law has made a very clear distinction between situations where an insurance carrier takes no action upon receiving a complaint, doesn't either defend subject to a reservation of rights and doesn't file a declaratory action, and situations where the insurer files a declaratory action. In cases where the insurer files a declaratory judgment action, the courts have made it abundantly clear that facts external to the underlying complaint can be considered. And I think the Envirodyne case is probably the case that's most instructive in this regard, Your Honor. And that case, by the way, was recently approved by the Illinois Supreme Court in the Pekin case. And in the Envirodyne case, the court said that while it is true in the first instance that the duty to defend flows from the allegations of the underlying complaint, this is the concern at the initial stage of proceedings when an insurance company encounters the first decision of whether to defend its insured. However, if it opts to file a declaratory proceeding, we believe that it may properly challenge the existence of such a duty by offering evidence to prove that the insured's action fell within the limitations of the policy's exclusions.
But isn't your argument that you don't have the burden to produce any such evidence until summary judgment?
Exactly. And the Fidelity case was a summary judgment case, Your Honor. But I think
I know that.
Pending until we get to the summary judgment stage, this court, the trial court, and this court are required to accept as true the factual allegations in my complaint. The factual allegations were sufficient when coupled with the underlying complaint to take this outside of the duty to defend.
Is that strain of Illinois case law applicable to cases where an exclusion arguably applies in the policy, or cases where the policy language itself may not cover in terms of the grant of coverage?
The Envirodyne case, I believe, was an exclusion case, and several of the Illinois cases which allow these talk about the fact that an insurance company may establish that an exclusion applies. Obviously, my burden of proof is higher for an exclusion. I have to establish that it is clear on its face that the exclusion applies. But I can provide facts outside of the underlying complaint. And I think Illinois case law is very clear on this. So then the question is, do I have to present evidence?
That clear, we're going to have to overrule quite a bunch of our cases, because we have said the opposite about Illinois law.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
If you are correct, you are asking us to overrule, I should think, at least a dozen of our cases, which have repeatedly held the opposite about Illinois law. Now, maybe we're wrong.
Your Honor, I'm not...
You seem to acknowledge that you're asking for quite a sudden change in the law of this circuit.
Your Honor, I don't believe I've seen those cases which have said that where an insurance company files a declaratory judgment action, it is not entitled to provide facts extrinsic to the complaint. And if it does, if that is the law, then it is contrary to what the law of Illinois is. Whether it's in Envirodyne or the case of the Pekin versus Wilson case where the Illinois Supreme Court made it abundantly clear.
Our norm is that when we do our best to decipher state law, we stick with it unless the Supreme Court of the state tells us we're wrong. What you're asking us to do is extend language in an Illinois appellate opinion and abandon circuit law on that basis without the intervention of the state Supreme Court, because Pekin certainly doesn't support your view.
Well, I disagree with you, Your Honor, about whether Pekin supports my view. I think Pekin
says that a counterclaim is effectively a new suit, which it is in both Illinois and federal practice, and therefore the allegations of the counterclaim can be considered. It doesn't remotely deal with the question about what is the relation between the allegations of the complaint in the underlying suit and the allegations of the complaint in a declaratory judgment action.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with you about that. Pekin specifically talked about the Fidelity case and said the Fidelity case got it right. It said that the Fidelity versus Envirodyne case got specifically said that the Envirodyne case did appropriately understand that facts outside the underlying complaint could be considered. And I don't think it's merely the Envirodyne case. Your Honor, I'm not familiar with specifically the cases you're going to need to overrule. They haven't been cited by either the district court or opponent, and I can't recall which ones they are. But I would suggest to you that the clear trend of the law in Illinois, both from the Pekin case and from the appellate courts, is very clear that facts external to the underlying complaint are to be considered provided that the insurer files a declaratory judgment action. The case law in Illinois is also clear. If an insurer fails to file a declaratory judgment action, the insurer is stuck with the allegations of the underlying complaint. And, Your Honor, I don't think Pekin was really saying that it's merely because it's a separate suit. I think the liability in Pekin of the insured in the Pekin case was still going to be determined by the allegations of the underlying complaint. However, the facts in the counterclaim had to be considered. The facts, now, those, that's not because, I don't believe that's because it was a separate suit, because the insurer was not being asked to defend the counterclaim. The insurer was being asked to consider the fact that self-defense had been alleged in the counterclaim and that impacted on the facts of the underlying suit. So again, it was being asked to consider facts external to the underlying complaint facts external to the underlying complaint as a means where the insurer would have to defend. But the court also acknowledged that an insurance carrier could do the same thing, and I think the rules are both are probably applicable to, I think they should be applicable to both insurers and insureds. That is, facts outside the underlying complaint are to be considered where the insurer brings a timely declaratory judgment action. And I think the facts of the as alleged in our complaint have to be taken as true under Rule 12C. And given the fact that Rule 12C allows me to make those allegations, requiring me to present evidence of those facts, as Judge Cole did in that case, is not in accord with Illinois law, and it is not in accord with the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. So for those reasons, we believe, Your Honor, that that Illinois law does allow this material to be considered. Your Honor, I think, assuming one is going to consider these, I think the law is also clear in this court, in this case, that the care, custody, and control exclusion did apply.
By the way, are you asking for any relief with respect to Clark Mall? The district court wrote an opinion saying that your client didn't have any duty to defend Clark Mall.
Correct.
And it entered a judgment saying that your client does. Have you looked at the district court's judgment?
I did not see
that part. The district court's judgment says you lose outright, completely, on your duty to defend argument. And that means you have a duty to defend Clark Mall. Now, I looked in your brief, and I couldn't see any argument concerning
Your Honor, I must confess I did not notice that aspect of the judgment. I read the court's opinion, and
It's depressingly common that lawyers don't read the actual judgment entered in district court.
Well, and I confess to that error then, Judge, and I would then ask for relief because there is no duty to defend Clark Mall. But
I believe the word is forfeited.
Okay. Understood. We would then be asking for, though, a finding of no duty to defend with respect to the other defendants. And Clark Mall, we believe, is not our insured, but obviously we mistook that part of the judgment. So... Your Honor, I believe that the facts of both Rule 12C and Illinois law make it clear that facts outside the complaint can be considered. Even Judge Cole, I believe, indicated that facts outside the underlying complaint could be considered, but he required the production of evidence, and I don't think there's any basis under Rule 12C for requiring a party at the judgment for the pleading stage to produce evidence. Rule 12D is not a mandatory rule. It doesn't require the production of evidence, and I haven't seen any case law which suggests that it's there. The other aspect, Your Honor, I just wanted to mention argument has been made that this is an issue that is central to the underlying complaint because of the issue of bailment. And I would note, Your Honor, that the Seventh Circuit opinion of Stuart Warner versus Burns National Security specifically said that while a bailment situation would be included within the care, custody, and control exclusion, the exclusion is not limited to bailment situations. So therefore, there would be no res judicata effect because of this judgment on the underlying case. It is not an issue central.
Actually,
to the
this exclusion case. Isn't even intended to target bailment situations, as I understand it. Isn't that right?
I agree.
It's essentially one of the many iterations of a your work exclusion.
Somewhat similar.
We don't
to
really
that.
Have that situation here.
No, I don't think this is a your work situation, but it is something where the idea is that under the exclusion, one has to have exclusive possessory control of the personal property. In this case, I think the facts as alleged in our proposed amended complaint made it clear we had that Discount Mega Mall had exclusive possessory control of the exclusive possessory control of the personal property. So, for the Your Honor, for the reasons stated in my briefs and in court, we would request that the judgment of the district court be reversed. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Stanley.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mike Stanley for the Discount Mega Mall, Clark Mall, and the Park defendants.
How are you dividing your issues?
Well, with respect to the admission of general insurance that the underlying complaint does not foreclose
I mean you and
coverage.
Mr. Ordower.
Mr. Ordower will take the last 5 minutes of our 20 minutes.
All right, Mr. Stanley, we need to begin with appellate jurisdiction.
Well, jurisdiction is based on Rule 54, as discussed before.
It's based on 28 U.S.C. 1291. This is allegedly an appeal from a final decision by a district court. Rule 54 just allows district courts to enter partial final judgments. Right? So what is the relation between this appeal and the remaining issues in this litigation?
Well, the remaining issues in the litigation have to do with indemnity on the property damage and indemnity on coverage on the underlying complaint, commercial liability. We did not object to their...
So do you agree with Mr. McVisk that there is no issue of any stripe in the district court concerning the duty to defend in any way, shape, or form?
That's correct.
You aren't seeking damages for violation of the duty to defend?
Well, those would be under the Illinois Insurance Act.
Yes.
Fraud.
An untutored reading of the complaint and counterclaims would lead one to think that you were seeking damages for an alleged violation of the duty to defend. But you're telling us that you're not seeking any such damages.
Well, the damages for under the Illinois Insurance Act stem from their general handling of the case, both the property damage and just the general handling of...
Well, the general handling of the case is certainly related to the duty to defend. If you mean by general handling of the case that they haven't given you a lawyer and they haven't defended,
and they have
that not. Is rather closely related to the issue that is before us on appeal.
Well, it's parallel to the property damage and every other bad faith act of the General Insurance Company.
Well, when you say every other bad faith act, is refusing to defend part of the bad faith acts?
Yes, it is.
All right. We plainly have no appellate jurisdiction. This appeal is cooked. I don't know how the two of you could stand up and say, no, what's going on in the district court had nothing whatever to do with the duty to defend. But, oh yes, the duty to defend, failure to defend, it has part to do with general bad faith behavior.
Well, I mean, their bad faith behavior has to do with their failure to pay the property damage claim.
That's an indemnity
issue. That's an indemnity issue. Right? That's why I was asking, is any part of your theory of why you're entitled to damages related to the duty to defend? If the answer is no, we probably have jurisdiction. If the answer is yes, we almost certainly don't have jurisdiction.
Well... Yes.
Yes, what?
May I bring in my co-counsel? He seems to have something he'd like to say.
We're not going to have you popping up and down. If you're planning to come back, that won't happen. If you want to hand the case over to Mr. Ordover, that's fine.
Well, could you restate your question once again?
What is the nature of your counterclaims?
Well, they're bad faith, fraud, breach of contract on the property damage, their failure to indemnify on that.
What does that mean? Does the failure to defend the case in state court play any role in that counterclaim?
The breach of contract claim?
You can characterize it any way you want. Breach of contract, bad faith, fraud. The number of words doesn't make any difference. I'm trying to figure out whether failing to defend plays any role in any part of what's left in the district court.
Well, the breach of contract is solely on indemnity for property damage.
Apparently, your bad faith claim is premised at least in part on the insurer's refusal to defend this case. Is that right? Or is that wrong?
Yes.
I don't think you can have it both ways. So it is. I think you were answering my first question. Your bad faith claim is premised on the insurer's refusal to defend?
Yes, in part, yes.
It is. You just say it is because it is.
It is, then, yes.
Okay. That's what we're driving at.
So, you know, everyone will stop torturing you.
So are you telling me that there's no jurisdiction in this court?
I think I'm telling you that you better turn it over to Mr. Ordauer because he has something to say.
Okay, I'd like to do that then. Thank you.
Court, please. Lawrence Ordauer.
Mr. Ordauer.
Yes, it is the duty to defend is also bad faith.
Why does this not appear in your briefs? Mr. McVisk filed a brief saying that what's left in the district court is utterly, completely, and totally unrelated to the duty to defend. That's obviously not your view, and it's not Mr. Stanley's view, but your jurisdictional statement didn't address this issue. It's absolutely critical when we have a Rule 54B appeal to know the precise relation between what's being appealed and what remains for decision in the district court.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Overlooked that.
Well, and apparently nobody sort of alerted the district court to this in the context of the Rule 54 certification proceedings?
I don't believe anyone did.
Well, let's say we have jurisdiction. What's your argument on the merits of the district court's decision on duty to defend? The court obviously required evidence at a judgment on the pleadings stage, which is usually not the right way to approach those sorts of motions.
Yes, I would agree with the Chief Judge's view of Illinois law. I believe that is the Illinois law. I believe it's clearly stated.
What about Envirodyne, which is a case from the Supreme Court?
Yeah. So Envirodyne clearly says, and it was quoted by Mr. McVisk, it says, however, if an insured opts to file a declaratory proceeding, we believe that it may properly challenge the existence of such a duty by offering evidence.
Well, right, but that doesn't happen at the judgment on the pleading stage.
Well, yes, it does, because...
No, it doesn't have to.
Well,
if take it on faith.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll take it on faith, but...
That was a clear mistake by the district court.
Well...
I mean, is it your position that a declaratory judgment action involving the duty to defend... that the federal rules are altered to require an insurance company to present evidence in order to defeat a motion for judgment on the pleadings? Is that your position?
Well, I'm not saying the federal rules are altered. What I'm saying is that you have to look to Illinois state law. Illinois state law is quite clear that evidence has to be produced. Illinois state law is out there. There's Supreme Court decisions. There's numerous decisions. And
that body of case law does not speak to the burden at a motion for judgment on the pleadings. It speaks to the ultimate burden that the insurer has to carry later on in the proceedings. Right.
I understand what you're saying, but if you could bear with me for a second, I'll get to it. You know, I'm saying that these people know what the law is in Illinois. We all know what the law is in Illinois.
Doesn't seem so, sir.
Well...
Certainly the lawyers in this case don't agree on what the law is in Illinois.
Okay. The Envirodyne case says you have to produce evidence. They know what the Envirodyne case says. Judge Cole knew what the Envirodyne case says. You know what the Envirodyne case says.
I think you're misinterpreting that case. That case says that the decision on a duty to defend question permits the court to look beyond the pleadings in the underlying case and consider evidence offered by the insurer in support of the application of an exclusion if that's the basis for the declaratory judgment claim by the insurer that there is no duty to defend.
Well,
that's very different from the way that you've suggested the case law reads. That sort of a standard doesn't do anything to alter the burden at a judgment on the pleading stage. That's an ultimate burden of proof.
What the lower court said and what I believe the law is that they have an option to convert a judgment on the pleadings to a summary
they
judgment.
They have that option. They're not
they
required
choose.
To.
But he stopped them.
Right.
No, he didn't stop them. They didn't do it.
No, look, just don't make any effort to defend Magistrate Judge Cole's total misunderstanding of 12C. It doesn't help, right? He was wrong on that. The only way to defend his judgment, if we have jurisdiction, concerns Illinois' substantive law about whether things can be shown.
Okay, Illinois substantive law says that you can produce evidence if you want to. And they have the burden to do that if they wanted to.
Is there a case that you can cite that would really help me that says the care, custody, or control exclusion cannot be resolved in a declaratory action because it might intrude on the negligence issues that are raised in the underlying litigation? Because it seems to me to be fairly common for this and similar exclusions to be litigated in a separate declaratory judgment action.
Well, I think we've addressed that in our brief, that if you do go into the care, custody, and control exclusion, go into the factual basis of it, you're going to come up with some sort of bailment, which is going to shift the burden of proof in the underlying case. And, you know, that would be deciding an issue that's critical to the underlying action. And that's something you can't do. You know, all these insurance cases say that everything has to be construed in favor of the insured. And you can't determine issues that would hurt the insured's ability to defend themselves in these declaratory judgment actions.
So can you give me a case? Because I couldn't find one.
I believe we cited them in our brief. I'm certainly sorry.
You understand my question?
Yeah, I understand.
That the exclusion cannot be addressed in a declaratory judgment action without intruding on the issue of negligence that this raised in the underlying litigation. So we are on the same page.
We have bituminous is 212 Illinois App 3rd.
Okay, and what does that say?
Well, it says that that's the law, that you can't determine critical issues in the underlying case in an exclusion, in a declaratory judgment for an exclusion. I mean, that's the law.
That's a general
Illinois
principle. How does that
apply
here?
Yeah, that's a general
here
principle.
Everybody accepts that general principle.
Okay.
So how does that apply here? Is there anything about that case that makes it analogous to what we've got here?
You mean something with the exact same facts?
Yes.
I don't think there's something with the exact same facts.
Okay.
I think
and
there's
the
plenty.
And the fact is that this exclusion really isn't a bailment exclusion at all, right?
Well,
it's a your work exclusion. It's a one of many, as I said earlier in questioning your opposing counsel, it's one of many iterations of the business risk exclusions in CGL policies.
Yeah, but just because it's not a bailment doesn't mean that the standard of proof isn't going to be different in an underlying negligence case.
Right, but the whole bailment issue is just sort of a red herring here. It doesn't apply to the application of this exclusion.
Well, it does in respect to the burden of proof in the underlying case. If you have a bailment, okay, it shifts the burden of proof in the underlying case. Just because you call it a bailment, you know, doesn't necessarily mean anything other than it shifting the burden of proof in the underlying case, and that means we have the burden of proof that we're not negligent rather than the plaintiffs in the underlying case have the burden of proof that we are negligent. That's a big shift. That's a critical issue in the underlying case.
I understand that, and that may be an issue in the underlying case, but it doesn't have anything to do with the application of this exclusion, which
doesn't depend
upon bailment principles.
No, it does, because what you're doing is you're determining a crucial issue in the declaratory judgment case that we're going to have to live with in the underlying case. And if we shift the burden of proof in the underlying case, I mean, what could be more critical?
Is there any case that stands for the proposition that this particular CGL exclusion for personal property in the care, custody, or control of the insured turns on bailment principles.
Turns on bailment principles?
Right, I think that the standard is equivalent. If the standard is equivalent, then you get yourself within that general principle that deciding the coverage question decides the merits question in the underlying litigation, and you can't do that. But unless those two standards, in other words, the standard for applying this exclusion and the legal standards for bailment are coextensive, then there's not an issue.
Well, I think certainly shifting the burden of proof is a critical issue in the underlying case.
I think you're missing my point. Is there any case that says that this exclusion means the same thing as bailment law?
No.
Okay. Then you've got a problem.
Well, I think. Okay. I mean, I don't. I think shifting the burden of proof is certainly critical to the underlying case. And
I'm not fighting you on that.
Okay. Well, I think that's the real issue. That's what the courts say by determining a critical issue. If you shift the burden of proof, that's clearly a critical issue that we're going to have to live with in the underlying case. Further, with respect to the exclusion, the exclusion not only goes to actual possession of the property, but it goes to possessory handling. So when you have care, custody, and control exclusion, they have to prove two things. They have to prove actual possession, and they have to prove possessory handling. In this case, there's no way they can prove possessory handling. Possessory handling is if you have a company and somebody ships goods in, just-in-time goods, and you use those goods for processing your materials, you have possessory handling of those goods. This case, you have a mall. You had tenants in the mall who had individual locks on their own spaces, which the mall couldn't get into. That's not possessory handling. The other cases concerned consignment, where, you had like an antique mall, and people left their goods there consigned to the people who own the mall, and they could actually sell those goods. They could wrap those goods up. They could sell them. They could deliver them. In this case, the mega mall couldn't touch what's in those units. They had individual locks on those units, and therefore it wouldn't be possessory handling in any sense of the imagination. So, thank you. Unless you have another question.
Thank you, Mr. Ordauer.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. McVisk?
Your Honor, if I may just 2 points very quickly.
Your Honor, the first point is with respect to the 54B finding, because obviously I would like this appeal to proceed. There is nothing in the underlying pleadings which alleges that our failure to defend was in bad faith, and I think it would be difficult for them to make that argument in the first place. So
I just heard both Mr. Stanley and Mr. Ordauer say
I appreciate that. I haven't
said that, and they want damages for your failure to defend.
I understand that, but I have not seen that in their pleadings. That's a mystery to me.
What is the bad faith claim based on?
Bad faith claim is based on our failure to pay the other part of the case for their big property damage. They've got a very large property damage case. They're saying that we took forever to
first party property damage case. But as respects this third party claim?
No, and there's a fraud case in respect to that and all this, but none of that has anything to do that I've seen with duty to defend. That's the first thing. And then the only other point I wanted to make, Your Honor, is with respect to the bailment question that Justice Sykes was mentioning before. If you look at the Stuart Warner versus Burns International case, as decided by this court in 1975, it specifically states that the exclusion is not limited to situations where there is a bailment.
The CGL policy was substantially revised in 1986.
Understood, Your Honor, but the care, custody, and control exclusion was not.
Okay.
Part of that revision. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McVisk. The case is taken under advisement.